During the past few years now, and in the past several months particularly, there's been a great deal of interest expressed in alphanumeric displays of all kinds. This is largely because alphanumerics have become endemic in particularly test equipment, which all or most engineers are quite familiar with. You can't turn around anymore without seeing some new digital readout device available. But besides test equipment or electronic equipment, they're becoming increasingly common in such things as dashboard or cockpit displays, electronic clocks, variable signs, in fact, a whole host of applications where information transfer is desirable. Now, the reason for this is because alphanumerics are probably the most easily intelligible form of information transfer available. All of us are quite literate and are very used to reading and absorbing information presented as alphanumerics at a very rapid rate. Presently, there are at least 40 manufacturers who produce and make some form of alphanumerics. Depending on what you consider alphanumerics, you can raise this total to as high as 100 or 200. And the present devices range from such things as the quite common and familiar Nixie tube to mechanical types, to rear projection types, to cathode ray types, and to others which employ much more esoteric phenomena. Under development at present are displays which utilize such things as the piezoelectric, the ferroelectric, the ferromagnetic, thermochromic, magneto-optic, photochromic effects. All these are currently being employed to get some form of alphanumeric displays. One of the simplest and most direct approaches to an alphanumeric is the use of visible electroluminescence from a forward-biased PN junction. During the course of this paper, I will attempt to describe the methods and criteria used in the design of such a device, the particular advantages or disadvantages of the approach, and the problems which we feel have to be licked before a commercial product becomes feasible. This first slide illustrates the two structures which are commonly used as an alphanumeric indicator. The first of these, the seven-segment numeric, I call it the numeric, is capable of producing all 10 numbers, 0 through 9, and several letters, such as the letter L or E, or any other letter which does not require a diagonal. The second structure, the 13-bar structure, which I will refer to as the alphanumeric, is capable of producing, again, all 10 numbers and all letters unambiguously except for a B and an 8, an S and a 5, the letter O, D, and the number 0. Now, it would be possible to make the letter B, perhaps, by using the center bar like that, but it's rather unaesthetic, and some other form or compromise might be worked out. The fabrication of these devices using the visible electroluminescence PN junctions is rather simple, reproducible, and direct. Initially, the pattern is cut, either ultrasonically or etched, using photolithographic techniques, into the material in which the junction already exists. The pattern is cut deep enough so that it is cut through the junction region and the individual maces are isolated. Contacts are then applied over the entire rear surface and in thin bars on top of the particular strips on the top surfaces. The wafer is passivated, usually with a doped oxide on top so that it is hermetic at the chip. It is packaged and covered with a clear epoxy. Now, in the alphanumeric display, the 13-bar display, only about 50% of the area is unused. Material cost being a consideration in these devices, this apparently at the moment appears to be a reasonable amount of loss of material to accept in producing these devices. However, on the numeric device, the 7-bar device, perhaps 80% of the area goes unused. And material being rather expensive, this may be an uneconomic way to fabricate these sort of devices. Another possible approach would be to dice up strips of these electroluminescent material and arrange them in the 7-bar pattern. The trade-off which one must make at this point is between the extra labor cost involved in producing this pattern by dicing up the strips or the cost of the waste in material. Presently, there are three materials which have useful visible radiative efficiencies. The first of these, and the oldest, is gallium arsenide phosphide, which is a compound of gallium arsenide and gallium phosphide. The second is gallium phosphide doped with zinc and oxygen. And the third of these is gallium aluminum arsenide, which again is a mixture or a compound of gallium arsenide and aluminum arsenide. For both gallium arsenide phosphide and gallium aluminum arsenide, the peak emission wavelength depends on the exact ratio of each of the two compounds used. Therefore, you cannot for sure say what your emission peak is. These next three slides, slide 2, 3, and 4, which I managed to skip over, show one of these devices made out of gallium arsenide phosphide, which have been actually fabricated. This first one, this is a dime, one of the few silver dimes around anymore, to size it. This is the alphanumeric itself. It's rather small, as you can see, rather compact. It can be made larger. The reason it was made this size is because of simplicity of fabrication. This next one shows a close-up of the device showing the letter R. You can see there is some slight problem with spreading down into these corners. However, on the upper bars, the spreading is quite good. And the next slide shows a typical display presentation of this, somewhat chauvinistic. RCA 637 is my group. The next slide will show typical spectra for two of these materials, of gallium arsenide phosphide and gallium phosphide doped with zinc and oxygen. You'll notice there's quite a difference in the emission spectra. The gallium phosphide with zinc oxygen spans well over 1,000 angstroms, centered someplace in the vicinity of 7,000 angstroms, between 7,000 and 7,100 angstroms. The gallium arsenide phosphide, on the other hand, spans a much narrower region of the spectrum, only about 400 or 500 angstroms at most. Now, with spectra that differ as radically as this, it is interesting to see what the eye response is in this region. The next slide presents this. The peak of the eye response occurs at about 5,500, 5,600 angstroms. The eye is somewhat a variable. This is just sort of an average of the human eye. You notice in the vicinity where the gallium arsenide and the gallium phosphide typically peak, the eye response is down by several orders of magnitude. Since the gallium phosphide spectra spans from 7,500 down to about 6,000, you have quite a range of eye sensitivities. And evaluating which material is the brightest, or apparently the brightest, is not a trivial question. As an aid in trying to decide which material is the best, I've defined something which I choose to call the visibility factor. That's VF. The visibility factor is the integral of the response of the spectra, that's G of lambda, times the response of the eye, epsilon of lambda, divided by 1 over lambda term, because the eye response refers to constant energy life, and the spectra, it was taken with a photon counter. And to normalize, we divide by the integral of G of lambda over lambda, so that the area under the spectra does not influence the particular result. Now, the visibility factor is all well and good, but it doesn't tell us too much. It's rather an arbitrary number. What is of interest is something which I've chosen to call the brightness ratio, which is the visibility factor of gallium arsenide phosphide in this case over the visibility factor of gallium phosphide. Now, by comparing the brightness ratios, we'll tell you for an equal efficiency which material will appear brighter. For example, if gallium arsenide phosphide emits at 6,200 angstroms, and both gallium arsenide phosphide and gallium phosphide have the same external quantum efficiencies, the gallium arsenide phosphide should appear 15 times brighter than the gallium phosphide. Or, if the gallium arsenide phosphide peaks at around 7,000 angstroms, and they have the equivalent efficiencies, then it's only about a fifth as bright as the gallium phosphide. Well, it would seem that by specifying the spectra, or the peak wavelength, and the relative efficiency of these two materials, one could easily choose the superior material. Unfortunately, in the real world, nothing is ever that simple. There are two major modifying factors, at least. First of all, the brightness, or the apparent brightness to the human eye, depends quite strongly upon the spectral purity of the emission. The narrower the spectra, the narrower the emission spectra, the brighter the line appears to be. Thus, gallium arsenide phosphide appears to be brighter than gallium phosphide when the brightness ratio would indicate otherwise. And second of all, it depends how you want to drive these circuits. If you are going to run a pulse circuit, for example, 1 amp pulse, 1 microsecond at 10 kilohertz, which is a 1% duty cycle, and an average DC current of about 100 milliamps, the gallium arsenide phosphide will appear about 1.5 to 5 times brighter than running it at the equivalent DC current. However, for the gallium arsenide phosphide, this is not true because of various physical reasons. The gallium arsenide phosphide actually appears a little bit less bright in a pulse mode. Therefore, it is strongly dependent upon exactly what application, how you're going to drive it, and a host of other factors in determining which of the two materials you would choose to make a device out of. Thus far, you may have noticed I haven't talked very much about gallium aluminum arsenide. That's basically because RCA's experience with this material is rather limited at the moment. It's the newest of the three. And also, gallium aluminum arsenide has been reported efficient only in edge emission. Since these devices generally rely on surface emission, there is some question of whether their applicability to these types of displays. Now, gallium arsenide phosphide is grown by what's called vapor phase epitaxy method on a gallium arsenide substrate. This method is rather slow, it's rather complicated, and it's rather costly at present. Now, the system can be modified by either using a large number of wafers at the same time. At present, we only grow on 1 or at most 4 wafers. Or using silicon and germanium as substrates rather than gallium arsenide, which is a much more expensive material. The external efficiency of gallium arsenide depends quite strongly on the peak emission wavelength. This slide shows a least squares fit of the external efficiency to peak wavelength. I only use relative efficiency because there's always some question of what the true absolute external efficiency is. You'll notice it changes quite logarithmically over a rather small change in wavelengths. The actual external efficiencies, which we have seen, peak somewhere between about 0.1% and 0.5%. Now, to determine which is the best wavelength to use for gallium arsenide phosphide, you would like to multiply this curve times the I-response curve, which is shown on the next slide. And it shows that someplace in the vicinity between about 66 and 6800 angstroms is the peak wavelength to use for gallium arsenide phosphide. This, therefore, would be the optimum wavelength if one wished to make an optimally bright display. Both gallium phosphide and gallium aluminum arsenide are prepared by solution regrowth techniques, or liquid phase epitaxy. The gallium phosphide is generally grown on undoped gallium phosphide substrates. It's a rather expensive method. Gallium phosphide is a very expensive material to prepare. Gallium aluminum arsenide is grown on gallium arsenide substrates, but also, again, a rather expensive method. However, both these materials have reported external efficiencies in excess of 1%. Therefore, they must be kept in mind. Now, in designing circuits to drive these types of devices, the alphanumeric devices, one must keep in mind, of course, the requirements of the display itself. The first alphanumerics we made required better than 200 milliamps per segment to drive them, a rather large current. Some of the more recent displays we have made require about 100 milliamps per segment, and some of the latest have been below 50 milliamps per segment. But this, again, is still rather large currents by some integrated circuit standards. If you desire to drive these circuits pulsed, you require circuitry which can handle rather large peak currents. The voltage required is about 2 volts at present. Thus, we have compatibility with transistors, with integrated circuits, with MOSFET type circuits, except for the current requirement. Now, the high current at present restrict the drive stages to bipolar devices. For these types of devices, there are many different types of inputs which are possible that you'd like to display alphanumeric characters off of. The most common, perhaps, is binary coded decimal, BCD. Some of the others are just plain counters. There are various and a large number of possible types of inputs that you could use to the input of which you would like to display. Therefore, you'd like to have your circuitry as general as possible. You could design a specialized circuit for each particular application, but this would be rather expensive. The circuitry itself would be rather complicated, and it would apparently be a rather uneconomic way to meet the challenge. What is needed is a more general approach. The next slide will suggest a method which is one possible way of attacking this problem. For simplicity, I'm only going to talk about the 10 numbers. We're only going to display the numbers 0 through 9. And no matter what input signals we're going to use, we're only going to have the display 0 through 9. Well, what we can do is, since we know there are only 10 possible inputs, you can only have those numbers, and there are only 7 possible output coded bars which can be lighted up, you can take an input with 7 possible inputs. This is represented schematically as the numbers 1 through 10, but it could be actually binary coded decimal, and have it encoded to the proper 7 level output to drive your actual display. This would be a general chip which would be applicable no matter what type of input into the display device was actually being contemplated. Then you would have a second chip which would take the input information and convert it to the proper 10 level output. So you could have a chip for binary coded decimal, you could have a chip which would take counting pulse and put out the proper signals, you could have some form of sequential coding, you could have an analog to digital converter, actually. If you desired other functions, such as storage and hold or sampling, this could be supplied by either an interface chip between your initial input circuits, or it could be included in the input circuits themselves. That would have to depend quite strongly on the particular application and the particular volume that you had in mind. Well, what conclusions can we draw? First, that it is possible, and we've shown feasibility, of making an alphanumeric by these methods. The advantage of this particular approach are several. First, flexibility. The fabrication is quite simple, and the form is easily changed, the size is easily changed. Second, compatibility. The current voltage are compatible with transistor and integrated circuits. Third, planarity. All the information is displayed on a single plane. There is no change in the plane at which the information is presented. Fourth, the devices are rugged. They're solid state and they possess the ruggedness normally associated with any solid state device. Fifth, the size. They are very compact. When integrated circuitry is used to drive these devices, we estimate that an entire display, including all decoding and encoding matrices, could be contained within about 3/16 of a cubic inch. And sixth is speed. The response time of the material, the electroluminescent material, is in the nanosecond range. Whether or not you would have any particular application where you wanted this speed is questionable, but at least it's available. The disadvantages of this approach at present are, first of all, cost. The material is expensive, the processes are very expensive. Second, the high current level is still required. This has come down quite considerably over the course of this program, but it still has a way to go. And third, size is a disadvantage in that the material is rather small. At present, the largest display we feel we can safely say we can make is only 1 inch high, but perhaps over the course of the program, larger material would become available. However, none of these disadvantages are really inherent in the approach. It is believed, or we hope. The material cost can come down. If it is grown on silicon or germanium substrates, the size can go up. Improvement in efficiency will enable the current requirement to go down. Therefore, if the disadvantages are overcome, and we feel confident that they can be, a practical, economic, solid-state alphanumeric display will become a reality. Thank you very much.